KALW.
I mean, I think that's exciting that there's been an investment being made in Hunter's Point.
San Francisco voters have had their say. What do the election results mean for Bayview Hunter's Point?
We just want to make sure that we have a say in what goes there and who gets to live there.
We hear post-election analysis. Then how an Oakland dance group became one of the biggest African dance troupes in the country.
We do not just move. We are telling stories.
And we'll visit Solano State Prison, where a man teaches a class on truck driving using a model dashboard he made by hand.
All this here is made out of cardboard boxes, recycled coffee creamer containers.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The country is starting the week with a new president-elect. For many people, it's been a weekend of celebration, others a weekend of protest. And while we've been directing a lot of our attention towards the race for president, we continue to also follow the aftermath of our local elections here in the Bay Area. Today, we focus on Bayview Hunter's Point in San Francisco and the results the neighborhood's been paying attention to. Policing is a big issue, and voters did pass Prop D, increasing oversight of the Sheriff's Department, and Prop E, that would adjust police staffing requirements. Proposition A also passed, approving nearly $30 million towards the development of India Basin Open Space Park in Bayview. And overall, in this historically low turnout area, this election, more voters cast their ballots there. Before the election, we talked to Megan Mitchell, a journalist at the news platform Hoodline, who reports on Bayview Hunter's Point. I called her up again earlier today for her post-election analysis. First things first, let's start with the mood this past weekend in San Francisco. What was it like?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there was just joy all around the city. And mainly, it looked like the Castro probably was where the big party was. I think as soon as everybody heard the results, you know, I woke up at something like 9 a.m. where I opened my phone and saw that wonderful news that President Biden took it. And I'd say right after that, people took to the streets and just started, you know, having a good time. Some of us and others of us were just like hanging out and really taking it in and just breathing and focusing on our breath.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the ballot measures that you were following, and how did those end up playing out in terms of the vote?
So one that I was really interested in that, you know, I don't feel people talked enough about was Prop G, which is the youth voting in local elections, like 16 and 17-year-olds. I know that this uprising that we've had in terms of racial equity and all the changes that we want to see within the city, even with police oversight, even with all these other propositions, a lot of these protest events have been youth-led, and the youth has really stood up and spoke about all these issues and have taken some real action. So I was surprised to see that that proposition didn't pass. And looking at data, it looks like, you know, over 51% said no of San Francisco and 49% said yes. But then when I look at the map of San Francisco and I look at the data of where people actually voted for yes, I think the interesting part of it is that it's mostly in underserved neighborhoods. So we have like Hunter's Point, Bayview, we have the Mission District, Haight-Ashbury are the ones that voted yes. And then areas throughout San Francisco, you know, Marina District, Telegraph Hill, Pacific Heights, even some parts of the Sunset, a lot of people said no. Mm. And I'm not quite sure what the reasoning is behind someone saying no. That's something that I would like to do a deep dive into. But I know that in several election recap meetings that I've had with like community members, mainly from the Fillmore district, a lot of them express their disappointment with it because they do feel that, you know, youth have a voice. And, you know, as we look at our future of you know, who's going to be leading the city, we want to start really engaging with people, you know, at a young age. I have to say, the youth has really stepped up. Even when we looked at what's happening with Lowell High School right now, how all the youth are coming together and, you know, speaking out and saying, you know, this isn't right. We deserve to be heard.
So let's talk about the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood, which you specifically report on. What was your sense overall in Bayview this time around?
I mean, I would say that I was happy to see that, you know, 16,000 people voted, but that is still very much a low, what I consider a low voter turnout. And, you know, it's hard to kind of pinpoint reasoning why people are not voting. But I would say that's better, you know, a better turnout than I've seen in a really long time. And that could very much have to do with the presidential election. Again, all the issues we've been facing towards racial inequity. I think a lot of people have stepped up, and I think we saw probably more younger people voting, like 18 to 22, which I think, helped get those numbers up a little bit. But we still have such a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. And then staying in Bayview, Proposition A passed, and that means investment of almost $30 million towards development of India Basin Open Space Park in Bayview. A housing development is also slated to be built next to the park. How do longtime Bayview residents, the people, feel about these developments and about Prop A passing?
I mean, I think that's exciting that there's been an investment being made in Hunters Point and, you know, the Bayview. I think, you know, like, we've wanted for so long. We just want to make sure that we have a say in what goes there and, you know, who gets to live there. You know, affordable housing is good anywhere in the city, but I think as it pertains to us trying to preserve the culture and the fabric of the Bayview District, which is, you know, predominantly African American, I think that this is a good step towards making sure that not only people who've been living here for years get to actually stay here, but then there's opportunities for people who may want to come back. And then there's opportunities for people to actually raise families.
All right. Any other propositions that you were looking at that folks in Bayview Hunters Point, you know, have been focused on?
I'd say Proposition 22 was really interesting, exempting the app-based companies from labor law. You know, again, I think this is one of those situations where I don't think people had enough information. And it looks like, interestingly enough, a lot of people in the Bayview District actually voted no. And that could very well be because, you know, there might be a lot of people who actually drive from these different apps. I also think it's interesting the way the proposition was worded. There's so much on these ballots. There's so much to take in and absorb. And I don't think people are really, really looking at these things.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add? What are you going to work on going forward?
I want to see what it's going to look like moving forward with sheriff oversight, you know, and the decisions made around police staffing. I definitely am following closely what's happening around India Basin. There's so many things that are being built around there right now. There's even new internet service that's being supported. A lot of residents have had issues with internet access. So there's all types of things happening in this community that I think is going to make it feel like it's part of San Francisco finally.
Megan Mitchell is a journalist at the news platform Hoodline. She reports on Bayview Hunters Point. We've got a link to her stories. Go to KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This year, the National Endowment for the Arts celebrated a locally renowned dance group. Jamano Kura West African Dance Company is based in Oakland, and its artistic directors, Zakaria and Naomi Diouf, were named National Heritage Fellows. Back in 2015, when the dance company was celebrating their 40th anniversary, Naomi Diouf, also known as Mama Diouf, spoke with producer Jen Chien about how Jamano Kura became one of the biggest West African dance companies in the country.
Tell me more about the origins of Jamano Kura.
Jamano Kura actually started by students. The inquisitive nature, the excitement, you know, that the dance and music brought to them. And, you know, they wanted for the Bay Area to see, because at that time, African dance and music was just, you know, it was in its infancy stage, you know.
Now that
and
scene is really
yes,
vibrant.
Now the scene, oh my goodness, it is so wide. It is all over. When you travel over the country, it is such a big scene. So it was the student who really wanted to do more with this. Jamano Kura means those who bring the message. So from the very beginning, it became a commitment that the company role in the larger scheme was not, it's performing, but it's more educational. So within our performances, we built a lot of educational, you know, mechanism, you know, where we do not just move, we are telling stories. One of the first things that people hear, there will be a narration, so that it's a first an introduction what the audience is going to see, you know, and why we want to do this piece. And from there, we take the audience into a drum call, and we call it an explosion of the sounds of Africa. And so they hear this drum call by these powerful drummers, so it becomes this powerful sound that puts them into the mood. And right now, because we understand most people have not traveled to Africa, we have introduced visuals into our production. So we go and we project a village. If we're talking about a forest, we go in a projector, you know, what a forest in Africa looks like.
Actual photos,
right. And what it will look like. And then we bring out this theater piece. The actors come out and they're actually saying the pieces, you know,
so they're telling the story.
Mm-hmm. You know, so they become a part of the story, because that's what we want them to do. Even though they're in the audience, we want them to feel that they are in this African village. It is so crucial to us that the audience become a part of our production.
And that is a cultural difference in terms of the Western tradition of dance being on a stage separate from the audience, whereas in African cultures, the
there is no audience, there is no, you know, production. Everyone is part of the production. And this is the tradition we carry on.
I'm speaking with Naomi Diouf, Artistic Director of Jamano Kura West African Dance Company. And when did you start dancing? What's your story with that?
Well, I started dancing from the age of 6, back in Monrovia, Liberia. I've always had a passion for movement, and, you know, I was always surrounded by it. Dance and drum is part of the culture and tradition. It is, I tell people first, they want to say, oh, just do dance. I say, well, dance and drum are inseparable, because it is a direct communication between the dancer and the drummer that happens. Within the culture, one of the first things that most people, children learn is actually through the rhythm. Mm-hmm. You know, you find, you know, young babies, you know, newborn, when there's music playing, the mothers usually tie them on their backs. And not only their mothers, sometimes their young sibling, you know, tie them on the back, they dance with them. So they are getting indoctrinated into that culture, you know, into hearing the sound, into feeling the vibration of the music, into learning the dance. So as early as infancy, really you learn, you know, the importance of music and dance.
You said that Jimonokura means bringing the message.
Right.
What is that message?
It's multiple messages because it depends on the current environment.
Uh-huh.
Because when the Liberian Civil War was going on, we introduced what we call the Liberian Child Soldier, which is what at the, I mean, it's still relevant today, mm-hmm. but it was to let people know, you know, the effects that war have on our children, and also that it's everywhere, because we were able to not only connect it to Liberia, but also in Europe where you have issues going on, wars, and to bring it closer to home in the Bay Area where you have urban, you know, street soldiers, the kids who are being given guns and whatnot. Those are also urban child soldiers, you know.
We just don't necessarily talk about them.
Exactly.
Like that.
We don't understand the relation. And so Jamilakura's role is to make the connection all the way around, that it is the same from country to country, from continent to continent.
And when people talk to you about what being a member of the company has done for them, what kinds of things do they say?
Well, one of the things, you know, they have said is that they able to go anywhere and know who they are. Because, I mean, sometimes the environment can be challenging for us, you know. So the dance and the music helps with that survival, you know.
Gives
so
a kind of inner strength.
Inner strength, right. Because you can stress, you know, you can stress in your job outside. You come to rehearsal, you hear the drums, you begin to move, you know, and something just comes there, it melts away.
What do you hope for the next 40 years for the company?
Our theme for this year is longevity. And, you know, we want the, you know, like you said, next 40 years, that will actually be that longevity we're talking about, because you have these new group of leaders that's going to take over the company.
The next generation.
And run with it, yes. And come up with something new, fabulous, more, because that's the idea. With each generation, you want it to be more and more fabulous.
That was Naomi Diouf, artistic director at Jimonokura West African Dance Company. She spoke with producer Jen Chien back in 2015. Jimonokura still holds classes every Saturday, only now they're on Zoom. Find more information at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, another story about creativity, this time from the Uncuffed team at Solano State Prison.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
Thomas Evans loves trucks, so much so that that's his nickname, Truck. He used to be a truck driver before he got to prison. Now he teaches a class for other prisoners who want to learn how to drive. Joe Kirk talked to Truck and produced this story, which comes from the Uncuffed archives.
When I first heard of Thomas Truck Evans, I was instantly interested. I wanted to know how a man without a truck teaches a truck driving class in a prison. It turns out he did have a truck. This man had built a simulated dash out of random scraps of cardboard and plastic containers. I sat down with Truck to ask him a few questions about his dash and the class that he runs with it.
All this here is made out of cardboard boxes, recycled coffee creamer containers. The simulated dash glasses are made out of baby oil bottles. The chrome is from the coffee creamer containers reversed out. And actually what we have here is basically for hands-on training. Some people learn better than just reading out of books.
And I see that your truck even has a little miniature engine that you build inside of it.
Yes, that's a Caterpillar. That's a Caterpillar engine. It's an inline six is what it is. And I don't know, you can put your own horses to it, 500, 600 horses. That's up to you.
All right. And is anything here make any noises or anything else like that? Or is there any sound involved in any of this?
Well, you have to make your own noise.
Yeah.
Yeah. I done got pretty good at it. I do it in the classroom. And a lot of guys, they'll look at me and they say, well, you kind of ventriloquist, aren't you? I said, I'm making sure you understand hands-on training and the different sounds.
Do you mind giving me a little sound or something? That you?
Yeah. That's what it does.
How did you first get into truck driving?
When I was a kid, hanging around a supermarket there in Fresno. And guy saw me looking in the truck and asked me, what was I doing? I said, I was just looking up in the truck. And he said, you want to make some money? And doing what? Help me unload the truck. I said, I can't mess with those cows. And he said, just with the cases. I said, all right. He said, how old are you? I said, 10. He said, wow, you're a big 10. And from that day on out, that's where it started.
I'd like to know what did inspire you to build all this stuff?
Inmate population and rehabilitation.
Yeah.
what inspired me is, there used to be an inmate here, JR, a long time ago, back in 2013. He wasn't a truck driver, but he just wanted to do something, so he thought of teaching trucking. So everybody was telling me about it. So he comes over to C-Yard, and I signed up for the class. He said, what's your name? I was a truck driver. I heard about you. He said, you don't belong back there. You belong up here. So after class, we started talking. He said, no, you don't need to be in this class. He says, I'm a lifer, but I'm getting ready to parole. He said, but I wonder, could you do me a favor? And I go, what's that? He said, could you keep this program going? He said, you're the right man for it. And I gave him my word that I would keep the program going. And that's just what I've been doing.
And as complicated as your class is, you get people that really are gung-ho to do this. Huh?
Yes. Well, you ought to see them.
Yeah.
Yesterday, my Wednesday's class, we did a driver's log sheet, which is homework number 3 from the truck driver's manual. And it teaches guys how to do the log sheet, which each page is a 24-hour clock.
Every trucker has to have a log in his truck.
Every trucker has to have a log. And now what they're doing ELDs, electronic log books, but it's still the same procedure. You just have to put it on computer.
Okay.
But at the same time, should that ELD break down on you, now you got to grab a paper logbook and you got to backtrack 7 days in that logbook. That's a lot of days to go back.
Now, has anybody in your class ever went on to be a trucker after they left prison?
Francisco. I don't know if you remember him. He used to be in dorm 8.
He went on to be a trucker?
Yes. He paroled to Woodland, California. He went to work with Walmart. And some guy coming to visit him told JT, sent a message to me, that he got his Class A license and he was driving for Morningstar Dairy.
Huh.
And once you start driving with the dairy, that's a permanent problem. You never leave the dairies.
Is there anything rehabilitative about your class, you believe?
Yes. A lot of guys I have had in my class, I noticed they have low self-esteem.
Yeah.
But I noticed once they finish it, their self-esteem is up. And I can tell by their conversation and the way they talk. And I always take the time to work with them and I try to paint the picture for the guy, say, okay, well, this is somebody that cares.
So is there any type of message that you're trying to spread by having this class?
Well, I've been hearing on the news a lot, there's a shortage of truck drivers, and I want to be a milestone to set the standards to probably get this country back moving the way it's supposed to be. And that's what I always have been, keep the country moving, keep the freight moving. And we have an old saying, rain, shine, snow, sleet, we got a schedule to meet.
Uh-huh. That was Thomas Truck Evans speaking with Joe Kirk, who produced that story last year in Solano State Prison. Our prison training programs are supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. Joe is out of prison now, and you can hear his story about what it was like to get parole during a pandemic on the Uncuffed podcast at uncuffedpodcast.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street. A typical city involved in a typical